Session number 12367.
Mr. West, reel 4.
Of course, there was the most stringent examination of all the security procedures ensued after that, and we were interviewed individually, and Harry Godsave and I were interviewed in different rooms and asked precisely what procedure we had followed on receipt of the coded signal. We both told the same tale of precisely how we'd done things to the second, exactly by the book, because that's in fact how it was. But it was so unlike real life that we were regarded as with great suspicion for a time. The story we were telling was too good to be true. The fact is, it was true. But in the end, of course, nobody was found guilty of any breaches, although my colleague further up the road at Kuala Kubu, Paddy Williams, who hadn't quite had the time to do things by the book in quite the way that we had, did suffer rather for some of the breaches of the standing orders that were revealed in that inquiry.
Were you there at Roang when Templar arrived?
No. After Roang, I came home on leave, and I arrived in the UK on the day Winston Churchill was re-elected as Prime Minister, and I remember that one of the first things he did was to consult Alexander, and they chose Templar to come out while I was actually at home on leave in England. And by the time I got back there, early the following year, he was already in place.
Had the situation changed much when you got back?
Well, quite.
That was in March 1952, I think.
52, yes. It was. There was very quickly, when losing Henry Gurney, he was a very nice man, but one was conscious that there wasn't a grip on the war that one would have liked. And by the time one got back, Templar made an enormous impact very quickly, using, I suppose, good old-fashioned PR techniques. And already there was beginning to be a sense of purpose. It's quite noticeable in the few months that I was away.
Did you meet Templar in Malaya?
Yes, I met him a couple of times, at a sort of operational meeting on one occasion. And then when he came to my posting when I was OCPD Sange Siput a year or two later, and I had been injured by then, and I was hobbling about a bit, and he said to me, what have you done to yourself, in his rather abrupt manner? And I said, I got injured by a kerosene can in Thailand, sir. Ah, yes, he said, I remember. I was wounded by a piano, he said. It hurts just the same, doesn't it? And that was our first conversation. And I met him again later on in Negri Sembilan. And then after it was all over and he was retired, we met occasionally for lunch on rather comradely terms that would never have been possible when I was serving at that sort of diminutive level when he was the Director of Operations and the High Commissioner. He was a very great man, and once he took a grip of the whole scene, everything changed. He took a grip on... in his final address, which I was present at, he said that when he arrived, he found in place a superb plan by General Briggs. I actually always regarded that as being largely the work of Calvert, but it was a superb plan. He said all I had to do was make it work and make all those concerned with it play their part. And of course he did that, and Churchill had given him the not just the military power, but the civil and political power as well. And he couldn't have chosen a better man to wield that authority.
Do you think the Briggs plan was superb?
Oh, yes. the concept was always right. The way people were put into settled areas, they were put into new villages, as we call them, taken away from the jungle edge, and put in secure, not at the beginning, not very secure, villages, was the right concept, breaking their links immediately with the terrorists. It then went on from there to into the social field and the political field. One of the things that happened was that running water was put into these villages and sewage, proper security. They had Red Cross and Women's Institute ladies running clinics for things. There was resettlement. The land that the squatters had settled on close to the jungle edge. And remember, these were Chinese. They were landless and largely they were stateless. And they were the main suppliers of the terrorists. What was very significant, which Templar enforced, was that the land on the jungle edges that they had stolen was then surveyed properly. And they were then, they then had to prove title to it, that they had been, they had cultivated, and they were actually given title to that land. And having suddenly a lot of landless, stateless Chinese, having bits of paper proving that they had title to a little piece of land, made a huge difference in their attitude to the terrorist movement and the war as a whole. It was one of the completely rounded aspects of a completely rounded policy that so thoroughly defeated the communist Malaya. It was political. Tunku Abdul Rahman was told that he was going to get independence and he'd better get on and get ready for it. There were these social and political changes all made at the same time as the military effort was being pursued with tremendous vigour and intelligence.
People often draw the comparison between the British in Malaya and the Americans in Vietnam. Do you think it was the Briggs Plan and Templar that made the big difference in the different outcomes of the two?
Oh, that's a very complex question, and I think to say yes or no would be to enormously oversimplify it. Vietnam was a 400-year-old tribal war that the Americans never understood. And not many other people did either. They did in fact try elements of the Briggs Plan in Vietnam with defended villages and getting the Aborigines on side and so on, but they never had people like us. They didn't have people who had made their lives and their careers there. Every American soldier had R&R. The most they ever served was a year, and of which 6 weeks was out smoking pot in Bangkok and getting syphilis. It was completely amateur by our standards, and they didn't have a civil service, a forest service, a police service. They didn't have an iron frame of an administration to help the army and the air force in Vietnam to the same extent that they did in Malaya. So they just weren't able to carry out any of these rounded policies that might have changed the views of the Vietnamese. It's a very complex argument, but not just a Templar on his own couldn't have changed it. Neither could have any single military method.
And of course, in Malaya, you had the threefold division of the population there. We haven't said anything about that yet, about the fact that you had the Chinese, Malays and Tamils. How important was that division of the population to the winning of the emergency?
Well, it was enormously important from the very beginning. The Malays were antipathetic to the Chinese anyway, who made up the bulk of the terrorist movement, although there were some Malay terrorist units. They were not sure they wanted independence. They certainly didn't want to be ruled by these goons who carried guns around the jungle. So the Malay population was on our side from the very outset. And the way they flocked to the flag wasn't just the $100 a month they were getting, but they actually did want to take part in staving off an attempt by this principally Chinese and Marxist movement to take over their country. So you had that half of the population on your side to begin with. That is, barring one or two minor units in Selangor and Pahang. You had a number of the Chinese on our side as well, who understood the difference between Marxism and the market economy and various other things. But the vast majority of the Chinese at the beginning were, as the Chinese so often are, sitting on the fence. And it took quite a lot to get to nudge them over to one side rather than the other. And they would see and hear things, and they would keep quiet about it. Very interesting difference. You could go into the terrorists could go into a Malay kampong and shoot the headman. And then every Malay village for 50 miles around would be after them. The flow of intelligence, the recruitment into the security forces would surge. The Malays couldn't be bullied, but they could go into a Chinese village and they could murder the headman, as they quite often did. They would cut his throat and garrote him. And they would then hold that village in complete thrall. The Chinese would never utter a word. You could never find out who did it, although they probably knew. And information dried up all around there. They had, by their bullying, they were able to bully the Chinese population. They were never able to bully the Malays. There's a sort of intrinsic racial difference. I think the Chinese have always been bullied. They've never known freedom in the way that, in fact, the Malays have. And I think a friend of mine used to say, the Chinese have always been like that. The Malays are of Indian stock, and you really can't bully people in quite the same way from that sort of racial divide. And I think there's a great deal in that. And it took the Chinese a very long time to come wholeheartedly over and cooperate in winning the war.
And the attitude of the Tamils?
Well, marginal, because by and large they were pretty fairly ignorant, low caste. They were low caste in the Indian context. Coolies on estates, that was their main role in Malaya, and they didn't take much notice of the political events that were going on around them. There was a Tamil terrorist group in Perak, under a fairly grotty, cruel man called Perumal, but he didn't cut much ice, really the Tamils didn't matter in strategic terms, one way or the other.
Did you personally come into close contact with the kind of measures which the guerrillas carried out to pressurize the local population into supporting them? In turn, you said cutting people's throats.
Oh, yes.
And so on.
Oh, yes. We went into one village where they had taken an enormous stake, a metal stake, and driven it through the headman's head into a tree.
Where was that?
That was in Kajang. And in Sangisiput, where I was later, the head man of a rubber estate, the head supervisor, was the labour force were gathered round. He was tied to a tree, and they bayoneted him and cut his throat in front of his family, his wife and children. Those were the sort of methods they used, and one picked up some of the pathetic pieces fairly frequently. It never worked with the Malays. They could never intimidate the Malay. They tried, but it never worked. It worked with the Tamils, though.
So the Malays in the kampongs must have had considerable reserves of stubborn courage.
I think that's true. They do have. And, of course, they had Islam. and were free, are a free-spirited lot anyway. And they immediately saw Marxism as a threat to Islam, although they're not fanatical Muslims, but it was seen from the very outset as being against all religion.
What was your own personal attitude towards the guerrillas? Did you hate them or respect them or what?
I think one got affected by some of these incidents I've told you about, some of these ambushes and things, and some of these murders that one saw, and it was a lot easier to go hunting them when you'd seen a few of those. They pulled a lot of dirty tricks that, hating them was putting it a bit strong. There was a job to do, and there was a professional job to be done, and you could see, quite unlike Palestine, you could see the rights and the wrongs of the issues. And it was immensely satisfying over 10 years to go when it was very close to the edge and it was a close-run thing. And 10 years later, when I ultimately retired, most of them had been destroyed. The country was free and independent and prosperous. And I think there was immense satisfaction in that. I had lots of friends in both the Chinese and the Malay community and still do have. And I suppose, no, I didn't hate. The terrorists, a lot of them were near kids who didn't really understand what it was all about anyway. But there were times when you came close to it when you saw quite often one's own friends were ambushed and killed.
Did you ever think that they could win?
No. There were some dark times, but no.
What was the worst time?
I suppose the 49 time, 49-50, when things were drifting a bit, and I think our own effort was short on leadership. We'd lost two high commissioners. Sir Edward Gent was a Labour man who had been put there in the first place, and probably made a mess of the early stages of the emergency by dithering. And then Henry Gurney, who was a country gentleman and a classical colonial civil servant. And I think there were times when one wondered whether the government at home was serious. They were a Labour government, and there was no great sympathy for the capitalist settlers out in the colonies. I don't think it rated very high with them, and one wondered about their attitudes. I think once, in a strange way, once Winston was back, as it were, the whole thing seemed to change. And I would put that as being the real turning point, and then Templar, of course.
When you first went there in 48, did you think that independence was shortly to come?
Well, India had been made independent the year before. There was a move towards independence. There was no real... The Malayan emergency was not an independence movement as it was in many other places. It was part of the international communist attack on the West. It coincided with the Berlin airlift. It coincided with the beginning of the Viet Cong attacks on the French in Vietnam. Coincided with the Hak Balahak in the Philippines, with a good many others. And I think Stalin was of the view that the West was rotten and it needed just a bit of a push and it would all tumble into the bag. Didn't work out like that, but I think that's about when it happened. And there was it was never so much an independence movement. Later on, within the next 2 or 3 years, you saw quite clearly it was going to have to be independent. The government stated quite openly that that was their objective. Malaya had to be ready for independence, first internal independence and then full independence within X years, I just forget what it was, and Templar made that quite clear. And it immediately robbed. He had, in fact, Tunku Abdul Rahman, someone to carry the baton, man much revered and respected, bit of a playboy in some ways. But Abdul Rahman was a great man to carry the mantle on and got tremendous support from all the communities. So any political disaffection with the colonial status of the country was quickly nullified by these wise moves. And one knew quite early on that this was a career that wasn't going to go on forever.
Can we go back and pick up your own career in Malaya? Because we said that you returned in March 1952. To do what?
Well, when I returned, I remember landing, I went by sea, as one did those days, landing at Penang and getting a note saying that I was to report to the CPO Pera and to take over as officer commanding number 20 Federal Jungle Company, and in brackets, the Pera Aboriginal Areas Constabulary. The state of Pera had, where a great many Aborigines were concentrated, had off its own bat formed a private army it was in fact a four platoon strong of paramilitaries whose job was to go into the jungle and help and work with the Aborigines. It was largely the work of their game warden, one George Leonard, who was sympathetic to animals and Aborigines in that order, and wanted rather passionately to do something for the Aboriginal community, and could see that particularly in Pera they were fairly not more than a day's march into the jungle and were caught up in terrorism to a lesser or greater extent. He recruited a series of what they called emergency officers, emergency liaison officers, who weren't actually very good at it. One of them was Colin Park, whose dad was Air Vice Marshal, Sir Keith Park, Lou Brown, Garnham, and they they didn't belong to any organized force. They were a little private army, and they took to doing silly things. They used to go up to a place on the Palouse River called the Fort Luckham and spend the Monday to Friday there, having the odd sortie, talking to some Aborigines, and then would shove off down the river by raft, fishing. They were fishing and hunting gentlemen, and go off to Penang for the weekend, for all the things that one did in Penang at the weekends. And then they would come back on Monday morning and go back into the jungle again. It was a 9-to-5 job. Well, the terrorists observed this for a month or two, and then one Friday afternoon ambushed them as they drifted down the river on their rafts and killed them all. So when I got off this boat in Penang, I was sent straight down to Pera, where I found the only officer I had was a man called Dara Singh, a Sikh who was in Taiping. There were four platoons in different places, and one had to find out where they were. One had to turn them into one had to recruit them all, fingerprint them, train them, take them on into the police force, the regular police force, take them away from the state government, and then write a role for them, because they didn't specifically have one, and organize them into the sort of thing I'd been doing with the SAS, using the Calvert model, going into the jungle, setting up bases, winning them over, and using them as an intelligence, turning them from an intelligence screen for the terrorists to ourselves. Well, Pal and I recruited my own friends around me in this little unit, one of them a fellow called Marzell Dawson, and we wrote, the state government wanted us to write our own role. So we wrote it. Great fun writing it. It then was adopted with some changes, it became a directive, DIVOPS Directive Number 17, which is the control and administration of the Aborigines in the deep jungle. But that was basically the paper we'd written. And we were very happy. There was nobody like Pew on the outside to argue with us. We just went off going into the bush and working with the Aborigines. We set up Legap, Jaw, and one or two others. And we had a lovely time. And that was a very satisfying period. It carried on. I got typhus and got invalided out of that for a time and was forbidden to go in the bush. Marcel Dawson carried it on, and remnants of that unit and remnants of that role still live on now. They still have these forts in the deep jungles in Malaya. Usually now they're connected by roads. In our days, Legap, we had a tiny airstrip. And that role still continues. They are the manifestation of the civil government in remote areas. So, and I then had 6 months as a staff officer operations for the state of Perak, where I was planning and things
just
like that.
Just before we go on to that, are there any outstanding incidents which stick out in your mind from your days with the Number 20 Company?
Oh, there are lots. We killed quite a few terrorists. We were able to practice terrorist hunting the easy way with the full cooperation of Aborigines, and it became, you know, really a rather one-sided affair. But there was one small snag. We were in Legap in our little fort, and the commissioner of police came in by helicopter. And God knows why, but some terrorists were fairly near us, and they were attracted by that helicopter, and they came and had a shot at us in the camp. And Middleditch, who was commanding the camp, set up the usual pickets. We were terrified about the commissioner of police's helicopter. And I took a unit out, and we outflanked them and went round. We never found them. But the commissioner of police was always convinced that I'd staged it for his benefit. But that was that. No, we had some considerable successes, and I think the most satisfying bits were when remote tribes who we knew were helping terrorists would one day finally walk in to see us and talk about it. Our view then quite clearly was that you must never move them. You didn't move Aborigines into defended villages. That was the kiss of death. You left them out into their ladangs. You left them in their valleys. Because the moment you tried to move them, you would upset the balance of nature in the most spectacular way. If you move two tribes into one valley, the fish in the rivers would be fished out, the birds in the trees, the monkeys, the hunters.